Good morning. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 30th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning are Bruce Campbell and Jeannie Olson. Today's session number is CAB 2001-01, and it's titled, What's the Difference Between a Doctor's Idea of Care and the Patient's Idea of Care? Let's listen into their conversation.
Thank you all for coming. My name is Bruce Campbell. I'm a cancer surgeon. I work at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. And this session I suggested because it's a lot of issues around medicine and health and religion that I find fascinating and very troubling personally, just things I've never really worked out myself, despite being around people a lot who are dying, and families that are dying, and people from many different faith traditions, and people with no faith tradition, and people who just happen to grab the nearest one when something's going bad. And I thought this would be a way to try and draw some attention and some focus for myself. And and Jeannie Olson, who will introduce herself as well, was kind enough to help me with this, because I think the combination of a traditional medicine physician and a hospital chaplain, I think, could make for an interesting discussion. I'll tell you a little bit about myself, but I'm just kind of curious, are there people in the room that are healthcare professionals or involved in healthcare? Okay. Any other physicians in the room? Oh, good. Okay. I said that I could say anything I wanted to. And how about clergy? Clergy background? Okay. And this is a voluntary question. We have people here who are cancer survivors. Anybody want to volunteer that? Okay. Because I think my perspective is primarily with cancer patients, just given what I do. Jeannie's has a little wider, more cancer, but other things as well. My goal as part of this session is to explore some of those issues related to cancer, and also to explore issues related to health. And then tomorrow we'll also have another session which we'll kind of try and pick up some of the things that we bump into here today that we want to talk about some more. But also to look as carefully as we can at the interface, which I think is an uncomfortable interface between traditional medicine as we practice it here in Western countries and religion as is practiced and espoused among Western religions. So, talk about your, introduce yourself a little bit.
As Bruce said, my name is Jeannie Olson, and I will be entering my 17th year being a hospital chaplain. If any of you can't hear, just raise your hand and we'll speak a little louder. 17th year as a hospital chaplain. My hospital is in Davenport, Iowa. It's a 500-bed hospital, and we have it on two campuses, so I share one campus with a colleague. My areas are cancer, as Bruce said. I also serve on the medical surgical floor, on the pediatric floor, on the neurology floor, and on the transitional care, where people are needing a little more time, get some rehab and so on. If I were to describe the hospital ministry that I do, one thing I can tell you it is not, and that is seeing every patient, walking into a room, patting their hand, reading them a Bible verse, reading a prayer out of a book, and saying, hope you feel better, and walking out. That is not what we do in the hospital that I'm working with. And I'm very grateful for the fact that at our hospital, the type of care that I would describe that we give is a listening, caring presence, where we go into a room, and even though we may have 240 beds in a hospital, what we normally do is take referrals. I'll go to the nurse's station and say, okay, who do you have on your floor today who's lonely, depressed, teary, out of town, not many visitors coming to you, and no flowers, or throwing bedpans? And sometimes it's the nurses who go, that would be me. And then you know that nurse needs a little TLC and a little listening ear before you go on to the patients. Our job is not only care of the patients, but care of the families and care of the staff, whoever needs us. And we're given license in this facility that I have a privilege of working in. If I need to spend an hour in someone's room, I do that. And the gist of what I do is getting patients to talk about who they are and what they're going through. We've discovered that patients who are listened to do better in the hospital. They're less on the call light, they seem to need less pain medication, they get out faster. I see some of you nodding your heads in agreement. It's that patient that's listened to that gets to tell their story that feels better and works through their illness better than those who aren't. So what I do is go in, sit down. If I see there's lots of flowers and pictures, I'll say, my goodness, it looks like you are loved by a lot of people. And all of a sudden, the patients start talking to me. And I give them license to talk about whatever it is that's important to them. And if I get them talking about their family, and all of a sudden they start to get teary and they say, but the real part of my family that's gone for me right now is I lost my husband 6 months ago. And they may never get to, I'm having my gallbladder taken out tomorrow. That may not be what's important. What's important is I lost my husband 6 months ago or whatever. So that's what I do, and it's one of the things I just wanted to kind of give you background on about what I do. So.
Good. I wanted to go a little bit about how medical decision making works, just a brief background, because I think understanding how physicians, you know, physicians and patients have very different goals in a medical intervention setting. And I think it's important to understand that. But we'll move from that pretty quickly into the title of this session was the difference between the doctor and the patient's idea of what cure is and care and the important aspects of the medical system. Now, medicine has changed dramatically over the last 100 years, and really dramatically, and I'm hoping we can hit a lot of the historical aspects tomorrow. But the one thing I want to talk about particularly, my interest is in cancer, is how dramatic the cancer has become in our society. 100 years ago, the causes of death were very different than what we're dealing with now. A lot of the deaths 100 and 200 years ago were sudden. People died of infectious diseases and overwhelming infections and died quickly. My dad, when he was little, in the early 20s, got an infection in his toe, and unfortunately it was right at the same time that Calvin Coolidge's little boy in the White House got an infection in his toe and died. And so my grandmother on the farm is hearing about Calvin Coolidge's little boy and hear her own son has an infection, and she was sure that my dad was going to die. And those were pretty common experiences. Death during childbirth was extraordinarily common for two or three generations ago. And many of us come from families where it was not uncommon for, you know, our grandparents' generation to have 10 or 12 kids just because you wanted to get a few of them to take care of the farm when they got through a couple of generations. So I think those kind of deaths and that perspective was quite different back, 100, 150 years ago and before that. A couple things changed rather dramatically in the early part of the 20th century. First of all, there was a guy named R.J. Reynolds who invented this machine. And Mr. Reynolds' machine was amazing because it could take crushed, cured tobacco leaves and roll them into little tubes and sell them in packages. And that changed American healthcare dramatically. The development of cigarettes really changed how we view health in this country. In the early part of the 20th century, the most common kind of cancer in America was stomach cancer. And it probably had to do with the diet, and in Japan it's a very common cancer still because of the smoked and the way that food is prepared, the cured fish. But in this country, stomach cancer started as the most common cancer in the early part of the 20th century and dropped to a very small proportion of American cancer now. You can just imagine what happened to lung cancer in the same period. Lung cancer went from being relatively unknown in the early part of the 20th century to being the most common cancer in America now. And the four kinds of cancers that are the most common in America now are lung cancer, breast cancer, colorectal cancer, and prostate cancer. And those four cancers, again, were relatively unknown or just not a big factor in healthcare. What that has done is taken the death experience, the experience of dying, from being One, 100 years ago, being a relatively short experience, rapid onset, sudden loss of a loved one, to being something that can be lingering and difficult, not only for the patient, but for the family, the caregivers, the healthcare system. You know, there's just lots of ramifications. And it's changed the way physicians have viewed their role, I think, in society, from being a role of someone who really had very little to offer medically except the opportunity to be present, to be the person who would be there to help a family into and through the bereavement process, which is what our medical grandfathers, and you know, not to be sexist, but they were guys, okay? You know, I'm sorry, I'm holding. But back in 150 years ago, physicians were all men. But that was the way the system developed. Was physicians were there to be present with families and to help with the process. And now physicians have adopted different roles. Some still maintain that being present is important, but some have gone to give people like Jeannie that job. And I think I'm a little schizophrenic on it because I do the best I can, but time constraints being what they are, sometimes it's very difficult to spend a lot of time with people as you're going through this. So that point I wanted to make specifically, that this role of the long and difficult process of dying has changed dramatically. Besides the change in the types of diseases, some of the technology that's been introduced has also prolonged the agony of death. Didn't have intravenous tubes, 100 years ago. Didn't have endotracheal tubes or tracheotomy tubes for breathing problems. Didn't have blood transfusions. We didn't have kidney dialysis. There are just a lot of things where, you know, if someone's kidneys failed because of a strep infection, 100 years ago, they were gone within a few days. Now they'll be on dialysis for years with all the problems, or a kidney transplant, again, all the problems that can engender, leading to a change in the volume and the chronicity of illness compared to what we had in the past. When I see a cancer patient, I have my practice, and I'll give you an example of a patient, let me think of a good one, but my practice is patients with cancers of the mouth and throat. So I'll have someone who, a typical patient in my office will be a guy in his 50s who's been smoking since he was 14 years old, a couple of packs a day, never really had any health problems, doesn't drink much, maybe just a 12-pack on a weekend. You know, he's been feeling pretty good. He had a cold about 2 months ago. It never really went away. He's got a little tickle in his throat now, and his voice has changed. And that, you know, if I had, you know, that's a typical patient for me to see. And what they will have done is they've gone to the family doctor. They've taken a couple of courses of antibiotics that hasn't cleared up. If it's a mouth problem, they've been to their dentist. Or they finally, somebody will say, you know, you need to go see somebody that does what I do. And so someone will come in and I'll do an examination. Now, my goal in that setting is to, first of all, I've got about 20 minutes or so. I've got to meet the patient, find out what the problem is, do a fairly extensive history of their other health problems, have to do an examination of their face, mouth, throat, identify what the issues are in the setting. This is a fairly, from my perspective, fairly simple, someone with a voice box cancer. And then I've got to order the series of tests we need to do in order to figure out exactly what the problem is. And we have to make a plan, provide all the education, and push the patient out the door, say, I'll see you next week when all the results are back. Now, I dare say my goals are completely different than the poor guy and his wife and daughters who are in the room listening to this, because they come in, and I know it. Well, you tell me, what are the emotions that the patients are feeling and the families are feeling?
Apprehension.
It's denial.
Denial, yes. Denial is excellent. We see that's the first step. Angry.
Frustrated that you can't make it go away.
Right.
Fear.
Mm-hmm. I hope you have a cure or whatever.
Well, they don't know that yet, do they?
And somebody should have picked it up sooner, and nobody told them their insurance would not cover this either.
Right. Yeah. And the insurance paid a little tiny bit.
How could it happen to me?
Right. So it's a, you know, fate.
Bargaining.
Yep. Bargaining. All of the Kubler-Ross mm-hmm. kinds of things, mm-hmm. they all come flooding forward all at the same moment. And my goal, unfortunately, is that I've got someone in the next room with a problem very similar, and I've got, you know, 15, 20 patients in the morning, and this is what we do. So I'm not solving that patient's real issues, but on the other hand, I'm trying to do what I can to move through the process. So jump forward a couple of weeks. We've got the test results back, the patient's got a cancer, and then we sit down and go over the treatment options. Now, for cancer of the voice box, there's a couple different things we can do. We can either take the voice box out with a surgical procedure called a laryngectomy, where we permanently separate the breathing passage from the mouth. So forever after that, they will only breathe through their neck. And they'll be able to swallow, and they'll be cured of their cancer, but they'll only breathe through the neck. The other option is a series of treatments which will attempt to preserve the voice box using a combination of chemotherapy and radiation treatments. We're part of some national treatment protocols, clinical research, to try and do other things besides take out the voice box to preserve what we call in medicine and something that makes sense to people's quality of life. So we talk about quality of life issues. And this appointment, you know, I'm being a little facetious, but you know, 20 minutes, you've still got an office full of patients, you're still trying to get through all of these issues, again, with as much education, handouts, materials, you know, come to our support group, here's somebody you can talk to, we're going to set you up to see the speech therapist. So there's a lot of things that are involved, a lot of gymnastics, and a lot of things, just the choreography of getting patients, from my perspective, through all this is difficult. So then jump forward another week or two. The patient, for whatever reason, has opted for, just to make it simpler, let's say opted for surgery. So to come in the morning on a Monday, they come to the holding area outside the operating room. In our hospital, a hospital chaplain will come in and talk to him, say, you know, how are you feeling? How are things going? The patient is, you know, like drenched in sweat. And so, oh, fine. Then we'll go through all that, and then they'll go to the operating room. I'll do surgery for 4 hours or whatever it takes in order to do the operation to get the cancer out. We check around the edges. We have the cancer completely removed. We don't see any spread of the cancer. The patient is cancer-free from my perspective. They go to the recovery room without a voice box and with an enormous number of changes, enormous number of things. And again, I've got a few minutes to talk. We go through the details of what they've had done. I talk to the family, I come back and talk to the patient, and then I walk out of the room. Now what's the patient feeling? I don't know if any of you have been through these kinds of experiences, but I just...
Abandonment.
What's abandonment, no?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Could be.
Yeah, they absolutely. Have no voice because they can't communicate.
Right. Well, we're going to
How's my life going to change?
Yeah. Right.
What am I going to do now? I can't talk.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How does that affect my job?
What's that?
Did he really get it all?
Did it, right, yeah. Because Uncle Bob, they operated him, and who knows, you know, mm-hmm. later on came back again. So, yeah, and everyone's got, and that's, I can tell people medical research. I can say statistically this is what the possibilities are of your cancer coming back. But everyone has a personal
right.
story. Everyone
how much
has.
Disfigurement has
right,
been done.
Right, how much, how, right.
Am I going back to work?
Mm-hmm. What will my grandchildren think?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, there are just so many things, and I cover what I can, but it's always a difficult issue. Now I jump forward another 6 weeks. The patients are generally in the hospital 4 or 5 days. We do a speech restoration procedure. They're starting to talk again. They're cancer-free. But my experience has been, someone who needs radiation treatments after surgery, every day they're coming to radiation therapy, Monday through Friday, sometimes twice a day, come at like 8 in the morning and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And it's painful, they have the marks all over their face and neck, they can't swallow, maybe they've got a feeding tube. They go through all this treatment, and it's usually about, after my kind of surgery, they'll they'll have the surgery. About 4 weeks later, they start the radiation, and the radiation lasts about 6 weeks. And then on a Friday afternoon, about 6 weeks later, we say, that's it, you're cured. And the patient, my experience has been that is a point, I don't know how you found, that's a point where depression and sort of this overwhelming sense of, you know, I've been doing everything I can to fight this cancer, and all of a sudden now I've got nothing left to do except sit and wait for another shoe to fall. And those are things that I try and be aware of as a physician, but I know those are things that, that we depend on others to help with a lot of support. But that's, so that's where the title of this session comes from. My idea of a cure is I've got the cancer out and I've done everything medically and technologically I can to take care of the cancer. But I don't know how well I can do with a lot of the other issues. And that's where that's where we're here to have a discussion about what the next step would be. Do you have any reflections on what I just...
Yeah, as you were talking, I was thinking, you know, we all need, as I started talking before, a way to express what we're going through. And when that, when someone says to you, you're cured, and you're thinking, like somebody said here, is it going to come back or not? And how am I going to deal with this? And how is it going to affect my life? Everybody needs a way to deal with that. And Bruce mentioned support groups, and I think they're great because you feel like you're the only one that's ever gone through this, and you don't know anyone who's gone through it. And to go meet with a group of people around the table who are all experiencing that and understand what you're going through is really important. I think another thing, and Bruce has a book here about the Cancer Poetry Project, and we've written the name up there about people who have written poetry about what they've gone through. Whether you write poetry or whether you journal, and I think that's so important, being able to get out how you're feeling and put it on paper is really important. Or if you're not a person who feels comfortable writing, if there's somebody you can go to, whether it's a pastor or a best friend or a counselor or somebody where you can work through what's going on, because this has now become a pivotal point in your life. You are not the same person that you were before because of what you've been going through. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say that my life is AC and BC. BC is before cancer, AC is after. Pivotal? Yeah.
It changes you. You want to talk about that or add to what Bruce said, how you felt when you got done, and then what do I do now?
You're the first person who ever said that when I walked out of my doctor's office, and everybody else around me is celebrating that I've gone through my last chemo. And you're cured. It took me another 2 months after I didn't feel good about it. I never did. And I thought I was going nuts. And I walked into work, I'm a teacher. I walked into work, I called in sick, I walked into work, I had taken a shower, I had barely gotten dressed, and then I couldn't leave. I didn't know what to do because it was all, everything fell apart. And I think just the mentioning of that, I recognize the time constraints and all that, but that nobody mentioned to me how much it would change everything. And that while you're in the battle, while you're trying to get up every morning and trying to be brave and trying to handle what's happening, that part is easy. That part was easy, sort of. I mean,
you knew who the enemy was. You knew what to do about it.
You had an agenda every day, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was crystal clear. I mean, it was probably the cleanest time of my life, when everything else just fell away, and it was just so obvious what I was to do. And then when it was all over, there was no answers. It wasn't as obvious anymore, and it got all clouded again. And
Were there certain things that helped you to get through that period of depression and wondering that if you were going crazy?
I had a gal at work that day that I ended up at school not knowing what to do, not being able to leave, not being able to stay. And this one woman stayed with me, and she says, "You're not leaving. I'm not leaving you until you come up with a plan, until we come up with what you're going to do." Mm-hmm. And got in contact with my doctor's office, and they got me in contact with a counselor who deals with cancer patients and survivors and families and stuff like that. And then medication to combat the chemical imbalance that that was happening.
So you had a plan, and you had a friend who was standing beside you.
Right. Yeah, and that's what got me out of it. And it happens every once in a while still, but I have that system in place. I know what to do now. Yeah. And it gave me something to do, too, because it was, when you're 30 and you don't know if you're going to be 35,
right.
And you always have a vision of yourself being 80,
mm-hmm.
you can't step forward until you deal with that. So.
Thank you for sharing that.
Any other thoughts? Yeah.
I have a little different perspective, Bruce, because I'm a family doctor. I come from a good hospital too in Minneapolis. It's a hospital that's about 500 beds as well. And just recently got unsolicited at one of the top 100 hospitals in the country. And subsequent to that, again, unsolicited, we got one of the top 100 cardiovascular hospitals in the country. And so those are really wonderful honors that our hospital has gotten in the last few months. Well, my experience is much more dilute than yours in terms of dealing with an intense cancer experience, because I'm a family doctor and I see patients full time. I do have the opportunity to teach some physicians about communication, which has become a wonderful advantage for me. And you just delivered a wonderful treatise on the find it, fix it mode of medicine. And it's what our, and this is no slur on you, because I want you there doing that for me if I ever need it. And I presume I will. Not maybe laryngeal cancer, that was a metaphor. Anyway, I think Jean mentioned something about telling the story. And I think one of the things that we as physicians often fail to do is elicit the story and elicit the patient's perspective and understand what is the meaning of this illness to you, and understand how can I help you the best through this. Now, we've gotten there inadvertently, sort of, because in the industrialization of medicine, we have tried to deliver a product that's the same for everyone and is done in the same fashion as we do things in the supermarket. We go to the supermarket, pick it off the shelf, and bring it home, and that's us. We want to do that with our medical care. And we do that because it's efficient, it costs less, but it's not always what people want. And I think this is a huge failing on our system, not on you, not on me, but it's a huge failing in our system, because we don't exactly know what really is best for people. We know on a science basis, but we don't really understand what is the best for people in here.
Mm-hmm. Unless they tell you.
Unless they tell us. And it's, there are certainly themes that people get. So,
I guess I'm just curious if people in the room find that their own doctors are good at gathering their stories in the process of standard medical encounter.
No.
I think it's more of a engineered approach to just what's wrong, let's fix it, let it go. Mm-hmm. And it is more efficient, as you mentioned. And that's, I think, what really generated more need for people like her, is we realized that there is more going on in these people's lives. You've got the guy over here that's the fix-it guy. He's far as the mechanics of the body, and then let the experts deal with the emotional stuff over here.
Well, the theologians came first. I'm not going to.
As far as in medicine, I think however long ago there was more of that split. Let's let these guys do what they're good at, because this doctor's bedside manner isn't anything anyhow. So, and we'll split it off more.
Let me just throw a little statistic out, and you may or may not resonate with this in your own experience, but someone did a study, and I didn't bring it along, and if I'd known I was going to do this, I would have, but a study a few years ago looking at the typical interactions between physicians and patients. And what they did was, patient walks in the room, the doctor introduces himself, click a stopwatch, after the doctor says, tell me why you're here. The average time between when the doctor said, tell me why you're here, and when the doctor interrupted and talked the rest of the session was about 20 seconds.
20 seconds.
It's hard to tell your story in 20 seconds.
Well, it's actually 17. Sorry. But now we're really good.
Yeah, so I mean, your point is well, I'm not quite as bad as I laid out I am, but
I didn't expect.
And we're on tape here for crying.
And 20 minutes is pretty good.
Yeah, so, okay.
There's another story that talked about two physicians went to visit, made a home visit. One took his coat off, handed it to the wife, talked to her for a few minutes, took a cup of tea, went in, sat with the patient, sat next to the patient. I want to emphasize that. Did the same diagnostic thing, left within 10 minutes. The other doctor walked in, didn't take his coat off, didn't really talk to the wife, went in, stood next to the patient, talked, got the same kind of information taken care of. Which one do you think they thought was there 20 minutes? Well, of course, the one that sat down, had the tea, talked to the wife, you know, et cetera, et cetera. They were there the same amount of time, but it was the body language, and it was the concentrating on, yes, you are part of the team because you're the wife and we know you're going through, and how are you doing with this? It was all of that care stuff that so was perceived as, oh my goodness, my physician cares so much about me. And how many of you ever had a physician touch you when you're in the hospital room, sit down and touch you? I mean, I don't mean in a right. diagnostic right. way. I mean, you know, how are you doing today?
It doesn't count if you're from Minnesota.
Yeah. Yes, Scandinavian doctors and German doctors may have more trouble with this. You were talking about.
I'm an occupational therapist, a pediatric occupational, and I have found the frustration on the other hand is that now I'm in the school district. You know, I have 35 kids on my caseload, either very disabled or very ill, you know, and you see them, I mean, 35 kids, 5 days, you know, for just 5 days, and you see them and you try to talk to the parents and then you have to go, I have my next kid.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, and you just know they want it. A lot of times I'm just holding the kids on my lap and talking to the parents, and I figure that's enough therapy because then they'll feel. But one parent said to me, and I thought that was great, because a lot of the kids, you know, even if I see them up till 21, I'm not going to cure them. Mm-hmm. But one mom says, but at least you care for my child. Mm-hmm. But it is, it's very, very frustrating when I'd love to have a caseload of five. You know, I see one kid a day. It is. It's very, very
time constraints are.
Yeah, Peter.
Bruce, I'm wondering if you might think out loud, and Jeannie, you too, about the distinction between a cure and healing. We speak of being in the healing profession, and when I read the New Testament, Jesus often healed things like blindness, didn't necessarily cure them. And I sometimes play out my imagination, if Jesus were here today, would he have the capacity to cure AIDS? I'm not sure, but he might be able to heal some of the associated problems that go with being stricken with AIDS or living in a society where people are divided by AIDS. And I'm wondering, you might just think out loud about that distinction and how you may practice the science of finding a cure or creating a cure, but you're also practicing the art of healing, which isn't the science. And that 6-week aftermath moment, short as it may be, brief as it may be, has as much to do with healing, perhaps, as security.
What was the last thing you said, Peter?
I'm just wanting to think out loud about,
okay.
Is there a meaningful distinction when we're talking about
absolutely.
Cure and care, and I'm just wondering,
absolutely. Do you want to start first?
Talking about doxology.
Since I can do absolutely no curing, and I, being a Martha, I grew up thinking I could fix things, and when I became a hospital chaplain, I realized I couldn't fix a thing, and I couldn't cure a thing, so I had to refocus how I functioned as a human being in my job as a chaplain. So what I focus in on is the healing part, and I think that healing is spiritual. And I think that there are people who know they have an illness that they are not going to get cured from. And maybe they're going to live with it for a while, but maybe that time is short. So what do you do to make sure that someone can die with a sense of peace and a sense of being healed, at least spiritually? And I think that's the biggest challenge in what I do as a hospital chaplain, working with all the cancer patients and the AIDS patients that I work with. And the place that I start with that is I ask the patient, what does this illness mean to you? Where are you going with it? I ask questions and I let them tell me what they need. Once I was working with a 52-year-old woman who was dying with heart and lung problems. She took my hand and I said, what do you need in order to die peacefully? And she said, I need for my husband and my children to let me go, that they will allow me to die. How old was she? 52. Shit, I was too young to die. And she knew that if they didn't let her go, you know, she'd feel like she had to hang on and hang on and hang on. We have managed care when it comes to health care, but we also have managed dying. And the interesting thing is, who's going to manage your dying? You know, do you want your physician to do it? Do you want your family to do it? Do you want to do it? This is the only death you're going to have, or your loved one's going to have. And so a person needs to be able to say, this is what I need. This is what I need to be able to die peacefully. I haven't seen my son for 7 years. That's one of my patients. And she needed to see that son and reconcile before she could die peacefully. Or I need to make my funeral arrangement so it'll be done the way I want it. Or, you know, I need to finish this particular project that I've started. Or as a young mother of three children said, I need to put a book together for each of my children with their pictures in it, and I need to write a letter to each of my children. And one of the hardest stories that I have to tell, and I can't tell it without choking up, is one of my friend's sisters was dying at 32 of cancer. And she said to her husband, I want you to go to Toys R Us and get a stuffed animal or doll that best meets the needs and the personalities of each of our three children, and bring me paper and pencil and envelopes, which he did, and he brought these back. She held the doll that was going to go to this child and wrote that child a letter, and did it for each of those three dolls. And then she gave it to her husband and said, put this in the den, in the top shelf. And the day of my funeral, after everyone's left, bring the children in and give them these animals or dolls and the letter. I can't imagine the horrible grief those children went through, but somehow they were helped through this whole process. Having that letter, which you can imagine, was the most important thing they owned in the world, and that doll or that stuffed animal. Because in the letter she said, when you're feeling like I've abandoned you and you're feeling lonely, and just hug that, because I have hugged it all night long as I've written you this letter. People, is that cure? Well, no, they didn't. Is that healing? Well, she didn't get healed of her illness, but she accomplished what she needed to do to be able to make her children, help her children get through that process. So everybody has a different goal and a different story and a different need, and our job as clergy and chaplains and spouses and daughters is to say, what can I do? What can I do to help you meet the needs that you need to in order to die with dignity and with a sense of peace and accomplishment? We can't project our, I know what I think a good death is, but I can't project that on anybody. They have to be, they have to tell me what they need. And sometimes if they don't know, I may ask them some questions. What, you know, what would you like to do in the, in, you know, about morphine and about, you know, do you want to die at home? Do you want to die in the hospital? But then some of those questions they need to ask the physician. Everyone, I believe, as a chaplain, is spiritual. Not everybody is religious. Not everybody has a church. But everybody is spiritual. So that dimension of who they are, the physical, the emotional, the spiritual, all those things have to be plugged into and addressed when someone's dying. That's a long answer. I'll let you respond.
Bruce, how about you? In a hospital, in a doctor's coat, what do you say about healing?
That's a good question. I appreciate your long answer because I had to go like this. I guess it is, I mean, there's a clear distinction between healing and curing. As scientists, we focus on the cure. Early in medical school, the story makes the rounds of, you know, there are guys out there like, I'm not going to pick anybody in particular, but say you've got really bad heart disease, you've got your vessels are clogged off, and you've had too much bacon and all this stuff that you've done to yourself, and you go to some world expert heart surgeon, and you know the guy's really nice and pats your hand and botches your surgery. I mean, what good is that? You'd rather go to somebody who barely looks up from a piece of paper and sends you this enormous bill but fixes your heart. As Ann Landers says, half of the doctors in America graduated in the bottom half of their medical school class. So there is no personality test with the MCATs. But the thing is, I can think of examples of patients I have cured and not healed, and vice versa. People that I have failed to cure, but I have done something with healing. And sometimes it comes a long time later, and a lot of it has to do with the relationships. I sold myself a little short, but I really do, one of the things I try and do in my practice, and I try and teach my residents to do, is to understand the context within which we treat patients. I work at a university hospital and at a VA hospital, and it just absolutely stuns me among America's veterans, and these are people that basically have nowhere else to go. Fallen through the social strata, and a lot of them end up at VA hospitals unable to afford care anyplace else. We will finish doing a 6 or 7 or 8 hour operation, this enormous change, the stuff you talk about, the big changes psychologically, physically, dependency and everything else, and there's no family. There is no one. And I would say more often than not at our VA, there's nobody to talk to. Or another, we live in Milwaukee, somebody to say, well, I've got a brother I haven't talked to in the Upper Peninsula. Room full of Midwesterners, everyone knows what the Upper Peninsula is. But, you know, and that is a very typical scenario. And they're in the hospital for quite a while at the VA because they've got no one to go home to, very thin social service network, and then you put them on the Iron Mountain bus and they go back up north, and, you know, maybe they come back and maybe they don't. They continue to smoke, of course, but that's... and so those are, that person, maybe I can cure him, but I will probably not heal him. And I don't even know if I have the capability of bumping him even a little bit towards the healing process. Other patients that I have, an example, I think I shared this with you last night, a woman that I first met when I was a resident in probably about 1983. And she had a tongue cancer, which had been a result of, she'd had a kidney transplant in her early 20s, had been on immunosuppression, which knocks down your resistance to fighting off cancers. And so, through no fault of her own, she'd never, and most cancers, she probably had genetic predisposition plus this immunosuppression, she got a tongue cancer, which we took care of. I was part of the team as a resident, and then I went off and did fellowship training, came back, and this cancer started coming back. And at first it was every couple of years, then it was every year, then it was every 6 months, then it was every 3 months, and then we just couldn't get rid of them. So here she's 48 years old now, got recurrent cancer of her mouth and throat, and it spread to her lungs, and it was really, pretty. Anyways, she dies. I'm sorry. I'm doctor. 2 weeks later, I got a note from her.
That's why we like you. You're a doctor who can cry. Oh, we like that.
I'll edit that out of the tape. Anyway, she, 2 weeks later...
You're not a surgeon with that one.
Yeah. Well, she had written notes to all of us who helped care for her over the years, and she had given them to her sister. And 2 weeks later, her sister put them in the mail and got them. And it was the most... It was a very moving thing, obviously. So, that person I did not cure. But in some little bit, I think I helped heal.
Oh, absolutely. So, absolutely.
Some of this stuff is held, you know, this other book, this Final Gifts, which is up here, you'll see some interesting things about in here about these kinds of issues as well. And this has been in the bookstore. I borrowed Kalista's copy, but I'm going to pick it up for you.
That book changed my ministry as a hospital chaplain more than anything beside my CPE experience, clinical pastoral education. Any of you who work in a medical situation, I would suggest reading this. The gist of it is that people who are dying give gifts to us. And when we are around people who are dying, we can give final gifts to them. And in this book, it talks about people seeing Jesus before they died, or sometimes angels, and sometimes seeing glimpses of the light and so on, of the other side. And it's written by two hospice nurses, and they just talk about their experiences. And having read that, just changed how I work with people who are dying. For example, many times people speak in metaphors as they get closer to dying. And I'm not going to go into all those stories because we only have 15 minutes. And what I'd like to do, Bruce, if it's okay with you, is just open it up and see if there's any other questions or statements that people would like to give so that we don't do all the talking. So the person who had their hand up there left. Okay. Somebody else. Do other people have questions or statements? Because, yeah.
This does not have to do with dying and such, but I've always admired the writings of Oliver Sacks, who described one book that I first had. And he described all these absolutely weird neurological conditions. And then he can't cure. We can't get rid of that. But he somehow helped these people to accommodate in their lives so that despite their disorder, which he cannot cure, he can heal them in that he helps them deal with life. And I think that's a great gift.
One of the things that I found is when people are telling their stories to me, many people who aren't connected to a church end up, as they get closer to their dying, reconnecting with the faith of their childhood. Maybe for some reason they have a church hurt, or for some reason they've been disconnected to the church, but the closer they get to dying, the more they come back to that faith that they had. I had one AIDS patient who was the most obnoxious human being I'd ever met. He kicked everyone out of his room. He treated his parents awful. It was awful. But we became friends, and I won't describe how that happened, but near the end of his life, in our hospital rooms, we have a cross with a victorious Jesus on the front of the cross. And one day he said to me, he said, "Jeannie, I know who that man is." Now, the theme of this summer is, "I have called you by name, you are mine." It's interesting that he didn't call him by name. He didn't call Jesus by name, but he said, "I know who that man is." And I said, "You do?" And he said, "Yeah, I used to go to Sunday school as a kid, and when I'm feeling really awful, and I don't think I can make it, I just look at him and I gain strength." So I'm just telling you that for some of you who are Sunday school teachers, or maybe some of your, you know, people have drifted away, some of our family members have drifted away, that connection that we give children is, you know, when they say that you raise up a child in the way you would have them go, that they will return to that. Well, I see that so often, that people return, and that's where the healing comes in. There was somebody else.
I'm an oncology nurse, and I have work in a practice that has 3 physicians and 1 physician assistant, and I might see upwards to 20 people a day. And that's just for chemotherapy. I mix and do everything. And before, I'm also a parish nurse. The other nurses in our practice is 2 other parish nurses. We touch, we hug. When they come in for their new consults, we tell them this is not a chemotherapy suite like you probably think you're going to see. We have dress-up days. We have humor days. We have patients who change their days of appointments for their chemo, depending on who's coming in and which patients bring in the cookies that day.
Wonderful.
And we talk about healing because we tend to get more of the questions and have to answer things than our physicians do. And when they talk about healing, they talk about death. We've done a lot of that. The healing is spiritual. Mm-hmm. And you know, I always ask somebody if I can pray with them, put them on my prayer list. And I do. I've learned a lot, so much from my patients. Mm-hmm. And we don't do children, we do adults. But we have taken care of a dozen or more pregnant women with breast cancer during the time, and to see them come back with their children, and just various things. And we go to patients' funerals. We don't just, you know, stop it there. I mean, they come back later on and bring goodies and stuff and cry. And it's the best job I've ever had. And I've been a nurse for 25 years.
It's a privilege, isn't it?
I love it.
Bruce has told me that he goes to many funerals, visitations, and writes notes to the families of the people that he has served. And I think, you know, what a wonderful thing to open that mail and see that your physician has written you a note of sympathy and concern. I mean, that's the human touch that I think, I really want to bring him back to the Quad Cities, because that kind of human caring, I think, is what it's about. I think physicians would be far less sued. I think what happens when lawsuits happen, as I've seen this in the hospital, is when the communication breaks down.
That's right.
That physician doesn't come in and speak to the patient and, you know, get things cleared up. I had a physician that misread my CAT scan, and for a week I suffered because of a subdural hematoma deep in my brain. That physician never came and apologized to me. 4 months later, I finally went to his office and said, "Hi, my name is Jeannie Olson. I think we need to talk." He just started sweating bullets. And he said, as he started to stutter, "The reason I didn't talk to you is I thought you would sue me, and my lawyer told me not to, and then my insurance company told me not to." I said, "I'm your colleague." And I said, "You misread my thing, and you know, then you never had the decency to come and speak to me and apologize to me." He said, "But my lawyer told me." I said, "I was never going to sue you. I'm a hospital chaplain. We're colleagues." I said, "All I wanted was you to acknowledge that you had misread my CAT scan." It was Good Friday. Mm-hmm. I decided if Christ was willing to forgive my horrible bag of sins, I had to forgive his. And so I said to him, he said, "Please forgive me." And I said, "I forgive you." I said, "Today is Good Friday." And I hadn't cried over this, and I hadn't realized how much I had been carrying this on my back till I walked in the chapel after this encounter. And I just burst out crying because I realized that I carried that anger and resentment toward him for a lot of months and was now at that point ready to give it up. But I can see how lawsuits happen, because you're so angry that someone hasn't communicated with you that you want to get back in some way. And I was never planning on suing him, but I did think he owed me something, which was communication. Communication, I think, is the name of it, whether it's between family members, whether it's between doctor and patient, whether it's between pastor and patient. It's communication. It's touching. It's humanness, right?
I think there has to be the balance with the call on these people's skills.
Absolutely.
Where, if nothing else, they can rely on knowing that, hey, this kid doesn't have mom and dad around, or this adult doesn't have family around, and say, and get a hold of you to say, "You got to get in there. I got to go to my next surgeon." Mm-hmm. But real life for me is that my child is under the knife for something serious, and there's another one waiting in line. I don't care what he does, doesn't do, just as long as he fixes that and fixes the next one, and then let the rest of us try and work out the healing and emotional part. But as an individual, that's got to be hard when you're sensitive to the healing needs, and that's got to tear you. You don't have the time to sit down with them. You know, "I've got to go to the next one." Yeah. But I just want to stress the importance of, to me personally, I dealt with that with my boy once, and I really didn't care that he had a good bedside manner or not. He cured, he fixed, or healed all the things wrong with my boy.
That, you know, it brings up there, Brett, that's a great, because there are different types of medical interventions. You've got the one where you go in because you want to have someone check your blood pressure and make sure you're healthy. Then you have the thing where there's an urgent problem. Then, you know, your situation where someone has a dreadful emergency that you want to have, you know, your the patient's and the family's needs for the physician contact and the level of personal relationship are dramatically different in those kinds of settings. Some physicians never recognize that they have to, there's a difference. Yeah.
I think we also need to be concerned with the healing of the physician. Obviously, Bruce was very moved by the woman who wrote.
I didn't realize how moved I was until I had a chance to tell the story.
Well, I'm sitting quite a ways back.
Yeah.
I wrote a brief note of thanks once to a physician who would fix something so I could continue being a musician. And he wrote a letter back to me, and he said he treasured it and put it in his thin file. Thank you. I mean, here we hold physicians in godlike places, and perhaps if we expressed our appreciation a little more, that would also help in the whole process, the give and take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think we often, because you are the ones with such great expertise, that we let you know that as a human being, you're also, you know.
Thank you. That's sweet. I just so Lutherans know this. I had a Russian Orthodox patient a few years ago that every time they would come in, the tradition in their culture was that. With good news, you celebrate with chocolate and alcohol.
Yay! So, you didn't want to give him any bad news,
no,
did you?
I probably would have only needed to see him once a year, but I thought I better keep a close eye on him, too.
Gratitude is pretty important.
Sure.
I have a young friend who was diagnosed at 3 years old with leukemia and had a bone marrow transplant from his baby brother twice. It took the second time. And so for 5 years he was in and out of the University of Minnesota Hospital. And finally he was able to celebrate a 3-year cancer-free time. And his parents invited all of the staff from the leukemia ward back from the University Hospital. And they were so overwhelmed. It was the first time they'd ever been invited to a celebration like that. Mm-hmm. Oh, and those who could came, and it was a 4-hour drive because this was
really?
In Minnesota.
Wow.
And they had a barn dance, and wow. They picked roast and had a great celebration. Wow. And the staff was overwhelmed.
Oh, I'm sure.
And it was
a great thing.
But the family was obviously very appreciative. And
well, after we have all 5 minutes years, left, so we want to make sure that you had your hand up, and then you had your hand up, and then we'll. Continue with our position. Did you want to say?
Yeah, just real quick. I think that the gestures of healing and of concern are very small, and they can be very small. They don't have to take much time. I have a surgeon who's a total goof in the office, and I love him on surgery day. I mean, I question whether or not I should go with him on the day of or the day before, but on surgery day, he's just right there. But just the touching, he would squeeze my feet before he went in, just that kind of connection before I entrusted him with what he was gonna do. And so I think they're very small. And I think also that we also need to seek out the person that's gonna help us in the healing. My surgeon isn't the one, but my oncologist is. And with, some help with a friend of mine who said, you're not going to stay with this guy, we're going to fight somebody else. I found a fellow who did have the time or made the time to talk and to find out what was going on and to teach me what was going on with myself at that time. And that's helped me with my own healing and my own situation.
Great, thank you.
I just wanted to touch base on a couple of things that Bruce said because I thought they were so important in the understanding of physicians' communication with our patients. Number one, relationship skills can be taught. And so if you have a physician who doesn't have them, it's something they could learn. Number two, I'll just say on a personal basis that the relationship thing is the most important part to me in the office. It's what certainly gives me my reward in the office. And number three, I think individuals can do one little small thing that you might try, and I'll say it's not my idea. There's a group called the American Academy on Physician and Patient, a wonderful group that is devoted to improving relationship skills. And they sent in their recent publication, sent out a little flyer that I thought was enormously interesting. They suggested this be put out in waiting rooms. And it said something about relationship building, and the suggestion was that while you're here in the office waiting to see your doctor, think of some little personal story you would like to tell the doctor. Because it's this way that we make connections with individuals. And so I'll go out on a limb and suggest that if you're having relationship problems with your doctor, think of some little story, your little trip at Holden or whatever it might be, and say, "Doctor, you know, I know you have a big schedule, but I'd like to take just 1 minute of your time to tell you this brief story about me." Try that.
Great.
See if it works.
Good. I have one closing statement. Do you have one closing statement? Okay.
You first.
Okay. I just, we got to stick to our time so you can get to lunch, but the one thing that I would want to say about what I do as a hospital chaplain, and I would also say about how when you minister either to family members or to friends when you visit them and they're sick, is when I visit a patient and I walk into their room, first of all, I know it's their space. And the things they tell me as their story and their needs and what they're going through and their fears and their joys and their griefs and their losses, I hold that as sacred. What they tell me in confidence. And what they tell me, I know, is the heart and soul of who they are. And I think it's such a privilege, and I'm going to get choked up, but I think it's such a privilege to be a hospital chaplain and to be with people at that pivotal and important and critical time of life. And I just hold it as sacred. And I think when you minister to the people that you love, to realize too that what they're going through is the essence and the core of who they are as they share their stories and fears with you. And you as family members can probably minister to them far better than those of us who just walk in the room. Though I have realized that sometimes a chaplain is a safe person because we don't know them. And so they're willing to share things with us that they won't share with their family members because they're protecting them. But just want you to know that what a sacred ground I find that to be.
Just, and being in a hospital is very much like a Holden experience for some people. You're going to see these people for a week, and you'll never see them again. So you have that freedom to open up sometimes, where you might not in other kinds of relationships. My closing statement is more housekeeping. Tapes of this session are available in the bookstore for purchase. If anybody's interested, you don't have to. We don't get a cut on it. if you want to carry on this conversation. And we are having a second session of, that we'll be facilitating tomorrow afternoon at 5. I think it's next door in the Creekside Room. Things I wanted to talk about a little bit are why are the medicine and faith traditions so divergent? I mean, why... You know, why is science and faith so exclusive in the medical setting? We can talk about that a little bit. But if any of you have ideas for other things you'd like to talk about, please see us right now. We'll put them on our list and we'll try and get through them.
We're flexible and we'll do what your needs are. So thank you very much for coming.
Yep. Another thing I offered we've got medical students here as well that work. People that are serving you salad up there. Some of them are going to be in medical school. If they're of the staff, missed this because people are working, please let us know. We'd be glad to do something in an evening and talk about it. So go in peace. See you tomorrow.
Thank you.